The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and it's so good to have you with us. Let's get to the politics. Votes for many of this week's local elections are still being counted. But it didn't take long for a theme to emerge in news coverage of the week's most prominent races.
I mean, Democrats are waking up. This is a gut punch.
The blame game among Democrats beginning, some pointing to the failure to pass President Biden's multi-trillion dollar spending plans.
I think what they have to do is look at last night as a blaring red siren.
Lower than expected approval ratings for President Biden and the party's failure to pass the reconciliation package were two of the reasons cited for the Democrats' underwhelming performances in Virginia and New Jersey. Here's President Biden on Wednesday facing questions from a reporter about his role in the Democrats' loss in Virginia.
Do you take some responsibility, and do you think that Terry McAuliffe would have won if your agenda had passed before Election Day?
I think we should have passed before Election Day, but I'm not sure that I would be able to have changed the number of very conservative folks who turned out in the red districts who were Trump voters. But maybe.
You won
the state by 10 points. No, I know we did, but I was running against Donald Trump.
And there's already been plenty of finger pointing. Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, a Democrat from Virginia, argued that passing a more progressive reconciliation package is not what the party's base wants. She told the New York Times, quote, "Nobody elected President Biden to be FDR." But to start today's show, we're going to talk with another House Democrat who says her party's electoral problems aren't because some on the left are pushing ambitious social safety net policies. Instead, her diagnosis is that the Democrats need to build trust with voters.
My name is Katie Porter. I represent California's 45th Congressional District.
Congresswoman Porter is the deputy chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and a member of the House Oversight and Reform Committee. And maybe her Twitter bio describes her best as, quote, "the minivan driving single mom, law professor, consumer advocate, usually carrying a whiteboard and always bringing the receipts." We started off by speaking about an issue that Congresswoman Porter has been a vocal advocate for, childcare.
We are at a 30-year low in women's participation in the workforce, and that is a result both of the pandemic, but also of a longer running problem with the affordability of childcare. Childcare costs have risen 1,000% in recent years, faster even than things like housing and healthcare. Even before the pandemic, childcare, for example, surpassed housing as the biggest expense for California families. So we need to understand that childcare is both an issue at the kitchen table for families who are trying to make ends meet, but also a big issue for our economy that needs to make sure that we have everybody who has contributions to make to our economy able to go to work. So Congress is our bill. Our proposal here is that make sure that families wouldn't pay more than 7% of their incomes toward childcare and also try to increase that supply so childcare is easier to find.
So as you're thinking about the childcare question, something we've been thinking and talking a lot about on the show, can you also maybe expand for me the ways that that's connected to other aspects of family need? So maybe I'm a sandwich generation person, so maybe also talking a bit here about elder and senior care, and then also those times maybe when one has very young children, sometimes 0 to 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, other ways also that we can create a social safety net for folks who aren't yet ready to go back to work.
Absolutely. So paid leave is smart and strong economic policy. And if we're going to be competitive in the global economy, we need to get to where our competitor nations have long been with regard to paid family leave. And while this is often associated with the birth of a child and the time off for women who have had those babies, the truth is that paid family leave helps protect both men and women, all different kinds of workers, against things that we know will happen to some families some of the time. It could be an elderly relative who is sick, who needs that care, and the ability of that relative to get that care in home with someone taking paid leave. So the pandemic was a real reminder of the importance of doing paid leave. But the reality is, for decades now, the United States has failed to act, as virtually every other country in the world has. And I strongly support the U.S. doing it. And sometimes people say to me, well, I don't have a child. I don't need paid leave. I'm not planning on, my family's all grown. And what I want to point out to people is, paid leave is not just about what you do with it. It's about making sure that your colleagues who you like and who are part of your team at work can stay in the workplace, can stay connected, and that your company that you work for retains their talent to be globally competitive and growing.
In that response, you've taken us to a bit of a different place, which is a question of political culture and a way in which we think about caring both for ourselves and our own households, families, and neighborhoods, but also a sense of broader connection to our neighbors, in the broadest sense of neighbors within our districts and our nation. How are you feeling about those kinds of social ties and our sense of collective responsibility towards one another?
I think it's really important that Congress emphasize and explain to people that policies are not about doing something for someone and leaving someone else behind. Instead, these policies are aimed at making sure that we have a strong and stable, globally competitive economy that gives everybody who wants to work hard an opportunity to get ahead. And I think too often people have this sense that Congress is only fighting for these people or those people. And in fact, what we should be trying to do, and what I pride myself on trying to do, is advance policies that will help everybody. Because I've never met anyone, no American, no constituent, Republican or Democrat, young, old, white, brown or black, has ever said that they want anything other than that strong economy. And so I think we have to help anchor these policies, not just in who gets help, but in what is helped. And the what here is our economy.
So in thinking about what Congress is doing and moving forward, I think we have to talk about the reconciliation bill, which feels very stuck. I guess I'm wondering at this moment, I mean, surely something is going to pass, and it's probably going to be historically relevant, large, impactful. And yet I wonder if there's any way for it to feel like a win, or if at this point it will always feel like so much was removed from that original top line.
Well, you know, as a mom, I'll make an analogy here. When you're pregnant and you're waiting that 9 months and you're trying to deliver that baby, you think to yourself, I'm never doing this again. I don't think it'll ever come out. I'm never going to survive this process. And you do, and you go on to celebrate and enjoy that experience. And I think that's what this is like. This is the tough stuff. We're in those tough moments. But I feel really, really good about these bills, about what they're going to do. And the fact that they are going to lift up our entire economy and give us a stable foundation, not just for a few months, which is what we've had to do over and over again during the pandemic. Congress has had to pass emergency bills like the CARES Act and the American Rescue Plan. These bills are going to put our economy in a strong place for decades to come. And so I think we will not only feel better when we get these bills passed and signed into law, and I am absolutely confident that's going to happen, but also that we'll continue for years to come to see the benefits of these bills.
Is there anything that's currently out that if you had a magic wand, you would make the priority to put back in?
You know, I think there's no doubt that there are problems that we face that we just couldn't tackle in this bill. I think, you know, the reconciliation has limits on what you can and cannot do. So for example, I'm really committed to campaign finance reform, voting rights, making sure that we're protecting our democracy so that everybody, regardless of their political opinion, is able to be heard and that's not drowned out by special interest money. We can't do that through the reconciliation process. That's not what reconciliation is for. It's for items that affect the budget. And so absolutely, there's a lot of work that remains to be done. And I would put voting rights and democracy reform, campaign finance reform, right at the very top of the next set of issues we have to work on.
So it's the first week of, we're here at the start of November, and clearly the election on Tuesday was not the single, headline best news that many Democrats may have wanted. But I'm wondering if you think the assessment of Tuesday as a warning bell for Democrats is a fair assessment.
think a lot about what I see as the fundamental political problem in this country, which is not a partisan one, which is that people have trouble trusting their government. And that's particularly, by the way, true of the federal government. And so I think that we need to be demonstrating over and over and over again, both in how we communicate and how we do our job, both on the bills we pass and how we conduct oversight, which is a passion of mine, that people can trust us to improve their lives, to fight for them, to understand their concerns. And so I think one of the reasons we often see, as we did on Tuesday, these kinds of swings back and forth, or these kinds of efforts to, we went toward Democrats, now we're going toward Republicans, back to Democrats, is because people really have trouble trusting either party to deliver for them. And so I think that's the real mission of the Democratic Party, is to say that that D stands for delivering. And that is what I think we're going to do with this infrastructure bill, with these reconciliation bills. And we have to recognize that there are a lot of decades of mistrust in Washington to fight for people rather than for big corporations and the wealthy. And we have to work over time to change that, or we're going to keep seeing these back and forths like we saw on Tuesday.
Is there a key strategy for building that trust?
Well, I think that, I often say to people who say to me, we need a message. We need a message. We need to be better at messaging. The reality is there is no message that any politician can spout off or tweet or come on TV and say that begins to compare with actually seeing your life improve. And so, for me as a mom who really struggles to pay for childcare, I want to see that actual policy. As somebody who was really hurt by the Trump tax plan that made it impossible for me to deduct my taxes in California, I want to see that policy change. So I think that the reality is there's been a tough period getting to these bills, but when people start seeing things change, they feel better. And I think a great example and a powerful reminder of that is the way the Biden administration has pushed out vaccinations and made them more available. I'm taking my daughter to get vaccinated the day I get back from Washington, D.C. And I look to the Biden administration and say, thank you for helping me to keep my daughter safe. And I think that's the kind of real life moment that people are going, that gives trust in government.
Yeah, it is on our weekend plans for our 7-year-old as well. So I think that is, many of us are smiling about what feels like moving into a safer space for our young people. Within the context of thinking about that D as deliverable or delivering, do you think that progressives have been unfairly labeled as D meaning difficult?
We're in a strong place right now where the progressives, I think, are really leading the caucus towards supporting these bills. I think we feel like we had a chance to fight for things. We got them in, strong environmental policies to protect our planet, for example. And I think that we're at a point where what we want to do now is be able to see these things in our communities. So there's no doubt that there is lots of people who, basically every, I don't know a single member of Congress, Democrat or Republican, who isn't at this point wanting to get these bills in the rearview mirror. Some of them, of course, are going to oppose them, and most of the Democrats are going to support them. But I think that, the progressives and moderates have a shared commitment to delivering on the president's agenda. And I think he's done a marvelous job of making clear that we are fighting for the American people. And that's the identity that we need to have, not our ideological or caucus identity, but our identity as people who deliver for American families.
You're a member of the House, but you clearly represent a district, and particularly Orange County in California. Can you talk to us a bit about holding responsible and accountable oil companies for the kinds of environmental degradation that we've seen, like the spill that recently happened off the coast in Orange County?
One of the exciting things in the Build Back Better Act are changes to offshore and onshore oil and gas leasing that will help us hold polluters accountable for the harms that they cause. Right now, companies do not pay enough in bonds so that when it is time to decommission, when there is a spill, they don't have enough money, and they walk away from these liabilities, often using bankruptcy and leaving taxpayers on the hook. So one of the exciting things in the Build Back Better Act actually is legislation to do exactly that, to reform our oil and gas leasing system, to make sure that when companies drill on public land, for example, that taxpayers get their fair share, and that companies who are making profits off doing this drilling are actually paying for the full costs of that drilling, including all of the cleanup. So absolutely remain very concerned about what happened in Orange County. Look forward to continuing the work I began with the field hearing I had in Irvine on the oil spill. But I think there's a longer term structural problem here, which is just we see over and over again, companies make these messes and they leave them for others to clean up. I wouldn't take that from my kids. I'm not going to take that from big oil.
You talk a lot about being a mom. And, you know, I think in some ways we can see that as, you know, warm, fuzzy, friendly. But, you know, moms often have to be kind of tough and sometimes have to take a fair bit of criticism. I'm wondering how you have experienced this kind of particular political moment, which can be, in fact, pretty brutal, I think, to all elected officials, but maybe particularly to women.
My children are definitely my toughest constituents, no doubt about that. And sometimes people will say, you know, I don't know how you get through the day in Washington, D.C. And I think to myself about what my days are like dealing with my kids. And I think, you know, I don't know. It all just seems pretty tough to me. But, I think it's important that we have people in government who understand what real Americans' lives are like. So when my kids say, you know, you forgot to fill out my form and the pharmacy lost my prescription and, you know, these are real problems that people have. And I think it's important that we elect people, both men and women, who represent those real experiences. And so, you know, no doubt that this is not an easy time to be an elected official. I would say this is not an easy time to be an American. I think about what our nurses and our teachers, our first responders, our essential workers have gone through right now. And I think, you know, parents of young children like me are also in that category who this pandemic has been a hard road for. And the solution to that is to make sure that we do better for all American families going forward.
You've said before that teachers changed your life. I am at my core a teacher. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, teachers were so important to me, both in terms of giving me the opportunity educationally to earn a living, to be able to support my family, especially as a single parent, but also in terms of showing me that information is really the start of being able to have debate and to have disagreement. And so one of the things I really try to do as an elected official is give constituents information when I'm in a hearing. And I'm using a whiteboard. What I'm really trying to do is get everyone on the same page so that then we can begin to have that back and forth. I can get answers for my constituents, for the American people. And so I think a lot of what I think about when being an elected official, I don't feel is that different than my old job as a teacher. This is really a teaching and learning job. I learn from my colleagues in Washington, from witnesses who come to testify, from my constituents about what's happening. And then my goal is to teach, to bring what I know into the legislative process to help craft legislation, to teach my constituents what's in these bills that are going to affect their lives. And I think that mindset that elected officials should be facilitating information in our democracy and then allowing people to make up their own minds. I think particularly as someone who represents a district with about equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans, I've found that, let me tell you what I know, is really the right way to begin conversations and to set people on a more civil path to having that political debate.
Every good teacher knows that class goes better when everybody has done the reading. What would be on your syllabus for the American people right now? What one or two texts do you think might help us to see one another or hear one another more clearly?
Oh, that's a really good question. I read so much, it's hard for me to even think about answering that. But I do think that we're going to be working hard to produce easy to digest information for people about what's in this bill. And I think there's a tendency when people hear that it's a big bill or it's taken a long time to assume that it's you know, that they could never understand what's in it. It's too complicated. So I think it's our job to create really easy to get at pieces of information. But I also think looking back at our country's history is always helpful. And people say, you know, it's such a scary time to be an elected official. We've had a lot of, you know, obviously January 6th and other challenges in our democracy. Looking back at our country's history, the House floor has long been a divisive place. And I think being reminded of that in times like this, that our democracy has been through challenges and that we've emerged on the other side is always helpful.
for little girls who might be watching, who are 14, 15, 16 years old and beginning to think about, in my adult life, what are the things I might want to do? Would you encourage them to jump into the political arena? Would you tell them to shy away? Would you have advice for them on it?
Yeah, I think that everyone should find a path to being engaged in our democracy, and that's going to look different for different people. Some people are going to run for office. Some people are going to volunteer in their communities. Some people are going to participate in our democracy by voting or by being part of organizations that work on issues. But I often say to people, you know, there is no, if you're looking at someone else and you're thinking that person is democracy, you're not looking in your own mirror. Each one of us has a role to play in this process. And I think particularly for young girls, for people of color who maybe have not been represented in this country, it's really important that they all step up. There is the way of the past that this job was done by people who were largely older, wealthier white men is not the way that this job is going to be done in the future. And that changes when people step up and get involved in the process.
Congresswoman Katie Porter of California, thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.